This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the health of our oceans. And it is increasingly clear that human activity has led to a very significant disturbance in the ecology of the Earth's seas, altering both their basic composition and their chemistry. One result has been things like fish and corals and marine mammals are actually in retreat, and some of the ocean's most primitive life forms, things like algae and bacteria and jellyfish, are on the rise. In this part of our program, we'll be talking about why and how these changes have come about and perhaps what might be done to reverse them. And our guest for the program is Kenneth Weiss. He's a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. And he was one of the authors of an award-winning series of articles that was published in the newspaper. Altered Oceans was the title. And you can read it if you want by going to the website of the newspaper. He and some of his colleagues won a number of awards for this series. It won the Grantham Prize for this year for 2007. That's a prize that honors the work of either one journalist or a team for reporting on the environment. It also won a George Polk Award and a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting, as well as awards from the American Society of Microbiology and the American Geophysical Union. He's been good enough to spend some time with us this morning to talk about some of what he learned in the course of reporting these stories, and we're pleased that he could be joining us by telephone. Just a little bit more about him. He's been on the staff of the Times since 1990, covering the California coast and oceans for the past 5 years. He began reporting on this series back in 2005 and has traveled all over the world working on these stories. And again, as I say, I'm pleased that he could be joining us to talk about them. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. Again, we just ask people to be brief so that we can keep moving along, but anyone who is interested is welcome to call. Mr. Weiss, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's really a very significant piece of reporting, and you're certainly to be congratulated on it and all the awards that it's won. I certainly think that it deserves that kind of recognition.
Well, thanks. It's been a bit overwhelming, but glad to see people are paying a little bit more attention.
Yeah. This, because your beat before had been, or before you had written about issues of the coastal environment in there in California, I guess it's not surprising that the Los Angeles Times would give attention to this kind of subject, at least in as far as it affects coastal waters of California. But what was it that led you, and obviously this would have had to been an editorial decision at the paper, really to put this kind of resources and spend this much time on a story like this?
Well, I can tell you how my own thinking evolved. If you will indulge me, I'll tell you a little fish story.
Sure.
Well, it really all started when I was a young boy in the 60s, and that time I was a brilliant fisherman, and my dad and I would launch our 18-foot boat into the harbor at Newport Beach, California, and motor out just a little ways and catch all the fish we could, we could in an hour, and filled gunny sacks, and they were so heavy I couldn't lift them, and my little hands would cramp up. And then if you just sort of fast forward, by the time I was a teenager, I seemed to lose my touch. And then as a young man in the 80s, I just had rotten luck, and fishing wasn't fun anymore. And if there were fish out there, I wasn't catching them. And I didn't really understand until about 5 or 6 years ago when I took on this new beat covering the coast and oceans for the LA Times. And I started going to scientific conferences to try to learn a little bit, and what I saw horrified me. And scientists like to measure changes, and they would parade up to the podium with their little PowerPoints, and the results of what they were tracking all looked the same. They looked like waterfalls, essentially, all these charts, and they call them waterfall charts. And whatever kind of fish, and just you name whatever you want, rockfish or tuna or whatever existed in the 50s and 60s just plummets like a waterfall. And it wasn't just fish, it was also habitat in the ocean. Everything seems to be changing in a very fast way.
Well, I think that certainly the one issue that has gotten some attention, it's certainly newspapers around the world have reported on it and books have been written on it, is the issue of overfishing. So we've certainly heard about the fact that the fish, what has happened over time is that the fish stocks that are available in closer to the coasts have gotten thinner and thinner, and that fishermen who are trying to make a living have to go out further and further to catch fish, and also the kinds of fish that they're catching have changed. So some of the things that had previously been very desirable fish, because so many of them have been caught, we don't have those things anymore. And now people are turning increasingly to fishing and eating stuff that in the past people would have just thrown away.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing that has gotten some attention, and we can talk about that. But I think that one of the important points that comes out in these articles is that not only simply are certain species, and perhaps we say, you know, desirable species, bigger fish and so forth, not only are they declining, so it's not just a case that they're declining, but something else is taking their place. And so that's another big part of the story that I think is really important, not just the fact that we don't have cod anymore and we don't have as many tuna and these things that are really desirable. It's not that there's nothing out there in the water anymore. It is that something has moved into that to take their place, and that has changed the ecology of the coastal waters very significantly.
David, you've got it exactly right. And what I wanted to do in the series was step back and look at this in the biggest way possible, but also make it understandable to somebody who's perhaps not interested in going to scientific conferences. So I actually think that the best way to think of this is consider the ocean as a swimming pool, a really big swimming pool. And there's a scientist who was an inspiration for the series named Jeremy Jackson down in La Jolla, California, at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And he likens it this way. He says, we've failed to follow the basic rule of thumb of any conscientious swimming pool owner. Be careful what you dump in the pool and make sure the filter is working. And so you know what happens if you let the pool go. It turns green and slimy, and you wouldn't want to set foot in it, much less eat anything out of it. In the case of the oceans, we're dumping all this farm runoff and partly treated sewage and slurry of stuff that runs off our city streets into the ocean. And at the same time, we've removed most of the salt marshes and coastal wetlands and forests that used to act as a filter for all this runoff. And then what we talked about earlier, then we've also, unfortunately, removed a lot of the shellfish and small fish that used to eat a lot of this algae that bloomed from these extra nutrients. And the result of all this are these enormous blooms of algae and bacteria and other microbes, some of them toxic and some of them ancient, and they're blooming all over the world.
Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting point, too, that the kinds of these sorts of explosions and these kinds of life form, bacteria, algae, jellyfish, things like that, it's not that these things didn't exist. And in fact, if you look at what we think we know about what the ancient ocean was like, maybe some of these things were the predominant forms of life. So in fact, what we have done, what human beings have done, is altered the chemistry of the ocean and given them an advantage again. And I think in, you know, one of the people that you quote, one of the scientists you quote in one of these articles says something like, what we've done is we've run evolution backwards and we're taking the ocean back to the way that it was a long, long time ago.
That's exactly right. Another way to look at this, another scientist I talked to said that these things have always been around, but in small bits and pieces. And he likens it to an analogy of a stove, of a pilot life on a gas stove. He said, the difference is now the stove's turned on.
Do you think, just to ask one sort of odd question here, do you think in the future we're all of us are going to be eating more jellyfish?
Well, I think
it doesn't
so,
appeal to
actually.
Me, but I don't know.
You know, I've only had it once, and it tastes pretty much like crunchy rubber bands with good sauce on it. I had it in a Japanese sushi bar. In fact, the catch of jellyfish are exploding around the world. We went, for the series, we went to off the coast of Georgia, a little town called Darien, Georgia, where the shrimpers there find that at certain times of the year they can make more money catching jellyfish than shrimp. And the reason is that jellyfish are proliferating like mad, and the shrimp have grown scarce. So when you factor in fuel and time and this sort of thing, they can go off the coast and quickly fill their hold with tens of thousands of pounds of jellyfish, where it might take a week to go out and catch enough shrimp to make it worth their while. And they come back, and it's processed there right at the docks of Darien, Georgia, and then shipped straight to China and Japan, where jellyfish is considered a delicacy, either in soup or in jellyfish salad. And there's a scientist up in Canada who's been looking at this, and he tells me that he's not too worried because he knows that his children will tell his grandchildren, eat your jellyfish. They're good for you.
Well, our guest is Ken Weiss. He is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times and has been working there since 1990, covering the California coast and the oceans for the past 5 years. Back in 2005, he began to work on what turned out to be a series of articles, the series that they titled Altered Oceans, that appeared in the paper that has won for him and some of his colleagues a number of awards. You can read them if you want to go to the LA Times website, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers here, so we want to bring them into the conversation. We'll start here with someone in calling on a cell phone. This is someone in Clifton, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks. As I travel across the state of Illinois, I appreciate you taking my call. Very interesting.
Yeah, sure.
Two quick comments, and I'll go ahead and ring off. I think what David said about the fishing different fish and needing the fish deeper, I think dovetails into the marketing of the Chilean sea bass or the Patagonian toothfish. Perhaps something a few years ago we wouldn't ever want to take onto our tables, and now, of course, they're trying to market it as a delicacy. But my question is, I don't know if your guests would know this, but I heard that for years the city of New York would put their garbage on a barge and take it out to the middle of the ocean and dump it. And I found that hard to believe. I was wondering if, in fact, that is the case, and hopefully you can tell me that that process, that method of dumping garbage has ceased. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Well, can you answer that question?
Well, sure. Yes, the dumping of garbage has, especially plastics, have become illegal in international law and national law. So that's not done anymore. There's plenty of illegal dumping. And you know, one of the things we looked at in the series was the proliferation of plastics in the ocean. And what makes plastic so durable and useful for us, it's lightweight and it takes a long time to break down, makes it so persistent as trash in the ocean. And about 4/5 of that comes off the land. It washes off city streets, or blown by the wind, down rivers and streams out to the ocean. And the rest is dumped by boats, generally illegally. It turns out that there's huge swirling mats of this stuff, because about half of plastic floats out in various places in the ocean. Scientists who study these call them garbage patches.
There's something I want to come back to, the plastic in the ocean, but let me go ahead to another caller here. Atlanta, Illinois is the caller. This is line number 1. Hello.
Boy, you just covered the exact question I was going to ask. I understand that the northern Pacific is one of the vortexes where the plastic gathers, and the bad part that it breaks down into little shreds that look just exactly, the polymers look just like food, and all these are, this plastic is being ingested by different species in the ocean and moving up the food chain, probably back to us. And I really was disturbed by reading this, and I was going to ask you firstly if this was true, which you've obviously answered, and this is right on your beat in from Northern California north, where one of the vortexes is. So I'll listen to what you have to say, and there you go.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, yeah, go ahead. This particular issue, plastic in the ocean, was one of the subjects of one of these articles. Why don't we talk some more about that?
Sure. The one that your caller is referring to is called the Eastern Garbage Patch, which is a little bit of a mind twister. If you just look at the Pacific, the eastern side is off the west coast of the U.S. There is another one off of the boot of Japan, and it's the Western Garbage Patch. The one off near our coast, it moves around a bit like this big beast, usually off of Seattle. It can come as far south as off the coast of San Francisco. It's been measured about twice the size of Texas. The plastic out there is very diffuse. You can't really see it from space. A lot of it is bobbing just below the surface. but there's huge amounts of it, and anybody who motors through it, you can't really sail through it, but anyone who motors through it is just astounded how much is out there. And just to get, I had a hard time getting my mind around this, but one analogy that works, I think, for me, is that it's similar to a hot tub or jacuzzi where the jets make the water swirl around the outside, and then the foam always gathers in the middle. That's essentially what's happening in the Pacific there. You have winds all around this huge, massive area, and the garbage tends to collect in the middle.
Mm. And does that, I don't know if this caller is still there, so get at your question, or did you want to follow up?
The only thing I wanted to follow up on is the ingestion of those little plastic shreds into fish.
Right. There's not that much science been done on that, unfortunately. I looked everywhere. There have been some looking at seabirds and others, and the problem, your caller is exactly right. It breaks down into smaller and smaller bits, and they suspect it's in, you know, they've seen it eaten by worms and some fish. Sometimes it's mistaken as fish eggs. One of the most disturbing parts of this is that plastics are actually act like sponges, essentially, and pick up DDT and PCBs and other sort of nasty chemical, man-made chemicals. And there is a scientist in Japan who's doing a lot of work looking at these pre-production resin pellets. They look like lentils, but they're resin or plastic. And they're used to make everything from water bottles to film to medical devices. They sort of flow like water through pipes and then go into ejection molds. Those things are everywhere in the oceans, and this fellow uses them as a little transport device to figure out how widespread have PCBs and other chemicals gone. Now, these tend to be toxic and can have all sorts of problems for wildlife, and one of the big questions remaining is how much is this working its way up the food chain back to us?
Yeah, that really gets to my question, and the point that you brought up, I think, is very important. Most of this plastic is land-based plastic. It's coming, like you said, down our streets and into our sewers and out in the ocean, and yeah, there is a small percentage off boats, but that's really pretty disturbing, and I thank you very, very much. That's really, really an important issue, I think.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. It seems kind of mind-boggling somehow, this idea that not only is there is all this plastic trash that's in the ocean, but that, as you say, most of it, four-fifths, came from off the land, and only a fifth is coming off of ships that has been illegally dumped. And I guess I just find myself wondering, well, how exactly does that happen, and how far inland could you dump some plastic and have that end up ultimately in the ocean? How does that work?
Well, the folks who studied this, and they meticulously count trash in the ocean, trash counters, it's every time somebody throws a plastic wrapper or bottle in a fast food restaurant, its trash can is over full and it dumps into the street, it ends up going into the storm drain. Storm drains tend to lead to rivers and creeks, and almost all of those head off to the ocean. So it's certainly possible, and I'm sure it happens all the time, that things wash off city streets in Illinois, go down the Mississippi through its tributaries, and end up in the Gulf. All sorts of stuff is found out there. This happens more frequently during big rainstorms, of course. That's when all sorts of stuff washes out to sea. And the other is blown by the wind. These little nurdles, that they call them, or little pre-production plastic pellets, they're very movable. And you can't go to any beach anywhere in the world and not see them sitting in the sand. They've been found in Antarctica and on Midway Atoll, which is literally in the middle of the Pacific. We saw them there. They're everywhere. And about half of plastic floats and about half of it sinks. So there was one scientist down in North Carolina who studies this. He's a polymer chemist, and he said basically every piece of plastic that we've dumped in the ocean is still there. It may be broken down in little bits and pieces and pulverized into powder, but it's still there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it underscores, as far as this and a lot of other things, something that no matter where you live, even if you live inland, that people really need to be conscious of the fact that so much inland water ends up sooner or later it goes to the ocean. You know, almost all roads lead to the ocean in a sense. And that's really, you have to think about the consequences of anything that ends up either intentionally or accidentally getting into inland fresh waters, rivers, streams, creeks, whatever. You have to think about the sewers. You have to think about the real possibility that eventually that water ends up somewhere flowing into the ocean.
That's right. I got a press release today that I thought was sort of interesting from American Rivers Campaign. And it talks simply about the amount of sewage spills that go on every year. I haven't checked their math, but they said there was 860 billion gallons of raw and partially treated sewage dumped into our waterways, about 8,000 Olympic swimming pools a day. And they're pushing a law that Congress is considering called the Raw Sewage Community Right to Know Act, because there's no requirement for sewage operators to notify the public anytime there's a sewage spill. And this is in every river, stream in America. This happens. A lot of the problems are that the sewage lines that we tended to put them in along the banks and sometimes laying them right in creeks and streams to use gravity to help the sewage flow to the plant. Mm-hmm. But then those tend to wash out and break, and we have a lot of, shall we say, deferred maintenance on our sewage system, so we get spills every day.
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Kenneth Weiss. He's a staff writer with the Los Angeles Times, and he is one of the contributors to a series of articles they titled Altered Oceans that ran in the paper. I think these all ran last year. Is that
That's right.
Right. And that people can, if you want to read them, you can go to the LA Times. You have internet access. You go to the LA Times website. You can read them. A really fine series of articles on the health of the planet's oceans. They have won a number of awards for this work, including a George Polk Award and a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting, and also the Grantham Prize, which is given to people who write about environmental issues. And again, you take a look at them. You can go to the paper's website. Also, of course, here questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And next, let's talk with someone in Chicago. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Talking about polluting the rivers and the lakes and the oceans, 99 people out of 100, you've talked to them about that. They don't want to hear about it. Either their eyes go roll up or their nose goes out of joint. But in Chicago, they don't know what they flush down their toilet or what they throw in the truck. They don't want to hear at all about that. It's somebody else's problem. In Chicago, we had what they call the brickyard. They filled it up with trash, and the trash got so high when we had the blizzard, the kids were all out there with their sleds. Well, that's all been leveled off now, and nobody remembers that. Used to call it Mount Trashmore. But I think you're beating a dead horse trying to get people to acknowledge what they do with all this trash. If it goes in the ocean, it's out of their mind, out of their sight.
Well, Mr. Weiss, that it seems like there's a good question there about how it is you get people, particularly people who don't. I suppose it's one thing, people who live on the coasts. If you live in California, or if you live in Florida, or you live in, along the East Coast, maybe you're going to have a greater level of awareness because the ocean is in your backyard, so to speak. But if you're a long way away, you live in central Illinois or Kansas or, you know, whatever, in the middle of the country, and you don't really think about the ocean, how do you go about getting people to at least give some thought to the fact that, yes, what I do here in my community, it does have some kind of consequence?
I think your caller nailed it. I mean, it's very difficult. Most people, including those who live on the coast, don't want to think about this. And the changes that we're seeing are really underneath the sort of shimmering surface of the ocean. So it's very difficult to get folks to focus on this. And that's one of the remarkable things, I think, about I was able to do this series. Believe it or not, it was a very hard sell to editors here because they share the same sort of, sense of being overwhelmed by these kinds of changes going on. And it's just too much to even think about. And with getting kids to soccer practice and off to school and getting to work on time, who has time to think about these kinds of things?
Well, I suppose something else that you're going up against, and it might even have been a kind of thinking that at one time scientists maybe even would have thought this way, and that is this idea that the ocean is so big, how could anything that human beings do really have much of an effect on it?
Right. I mean, I came at this as quite a skeptic myself, and was slowly persuaded by talking to scientists in all sorts of situations that we really should pay attention. And one of the things I tried to look at is not these big cataclysmic events that the newspapers tend to focus on, you know, hurricanes and tsunamis and other things, but instead the slow creep of environmental decay. And again, I thought, oh my God, the ocean's so big and so vast. How could we possibly change that? But we are a very industrious society. It's amazing what we're able to do, and scientists have persuaded me that we have started to change things on a global scale. Right now, for instance, we produce more fixed nitrogen, and that's the form of nitrogen that plants and animals need, essentially as fertilizer. And we produce more of that now through man-made sources than all natural sources combined on land. A lot of that's stripping nitrogen out of the air and converting it into fertilizer pellets and also burning fossil fuels. We've altered more than half the land on the planet, increasing runoff, cleared all these salt marshes, so we've increased the sort of flushing that goes into the ocean. We talked earlier about overfishing. 90% of the fish, big fish, are gone, the scientists have shown. And probably even more frightening to me is this idea that since the late 80s, the global catch of fish has gone down. So it's a bit of a mind twister, but there are more fishermen out on the water than ever before all around the world, but they're coming back with fewer fish. And if you play that out, it doesn't look very good for the long term. And at the same time, we've warmed the oceans by a degree, speeding up microbial growth, and we're stoking the oceans with all this carbon dioxide, turning them slightly more acidic. And if this keeps going on at this rate, it's not going to be good for any of us, no matter where we live on the planet. About a fifth of the world's population rely on seafood as a primary source of non-vegetable protein, and the oceans really control our climate.
Just real quick, and have some other callers here. The kinds of problems that you write particularly about in this series, the loss of desirable marine species, the death of corals, and the moving in of some of these less desirable things, bacteria, algae, maybe jellyfish, and some of the problems with human health that go with algal blooms that we've seen, things like the red tide. Is this something that is mostly a problem that is limited to coastal waters, and how far out from the coast do you see these effects? Or is there, and in some sense, there are whole ocean effects that you would say, well, it's not just that it's within 100 miles, that the extent really does reach out into much, much further than that.
Yeah, I think it's both. But if you're looking at what I primarily looked at, which is this bloom of harmful algae and bacteria, it is mostly in the coastal oceans, although there are some type that extend so far off of, say, Australia, that astronauts in space have reported seeing these big trichodesmium blooms. But generally, they are limited to bays and estuaries and coastal waters. That is also happens to be where most of the fish live.
Let's go on and talk with some more people who are listening. And the next is someone here in Urbana, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for being on. David talked briefly there about the dead areas, and that's an issue that I think we in East Central Illinois hopefully are aware of because we are a farming area here. And the wash of farm chemicals down the Mississippi through our streams and our channeled streams and such that are near the farm areas has caused that dead zone in the Gulf, right, in the Gulf of Mexico. And I was wondering, you know, we hear about that, but we don't hear about other dead zones around the world. And I wondered, that's probably not the only one. And I wondered if you could address that and how how people, governments, et cetera, are dealing with those. Thank you.
Okay.
Now, great question. Your caller's got it exactly right. We hear a lot about the dead zone off the coast of Louisiana, fed largely by all the nutrients washing down the Mississippi, mostly off farm fields. And I spent a lot of time in the series looking at this. What we're talking about is not the typical pollution that people think about, all the nasty, toxic, man-made chemicals, but rather basic ingredients and elements for life. Nitrogen, phosphorus, iron, carbon, these kinds of things. And we're stoking the oceans with basically too much food. And so just for those who aren't aware of it, what a dead zone is, essentially, is it's a low oxygen zone. So you have all these nutrients wash off the land, go into the coastal waters, and it creates a huge bloom of algae. That algae then dies, starts to sift down to the seafloor. Bacteria moves in to decompose that and strips much or all of the oxygen out of the water, and then anything that lives in the area that can't swim away or scuttle away dies. So you have these huge things. Now, the coast off the coast of Louisiana, there's been big fishing interests, and they're quite concerned because what this means for the fishing industry. And it is perhaps the best, one of the best studied dead zones in the world. And I also should note that dead zone is really not, is a misnomer, because there is lots of stuff that lives in dead zones. It's mostly bacteria and a few worms. And it's really teeming with bacteria and some jellyfish. But your caller's right. There's about 150 of these dead zones now around the globe. They're doubling in size and in number about every decade. What are governments doing about it? Virtually nothing, including the one off the coast of Louisiana. That's a great frustration for those who have been studying this because it's very difficult to get all the various states and others to get involved in this and change practices as simple as fertilizing in the spring as opposed to in the fall, so not as much flushes off farm fields into the Mississippi and down into the ocean.
All right. I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go to Belgium, the community nearby, not too far away from us. Line number two. Hello.
Good morning, Ian. Mm-hmm. I would like to point out that this all seems to stem right down to the point that we all worry about the price we pay for the goods we get. In other words, we want the cheapest thing from whatever source we can get. And we don't really want to pay for the true cost of what we do. I.e., take the case of the plastics. If we really paid the true cost of plastics, in other words, to keep them out of the ocean or pick them up in the ocean or whatever, we would become real resourceful with those things. We'd start storing them up. We wouldn't use them or whatever. So it comes strictly down to the fact that we're all kind of avaristic in that we want to get the cheapest price for anything we buy, pay the lowest price for labor. What it all comes down to is simply essentially the same thing. It's easier to dump the garbage on the ground than pick it up and carry it and put it in a proper receptacle.
Well, I don't know. Mr. Weiss, do you want to comment on that at all?
I can. I think your caller has got it exactly right. If I remember correctly back to my Econ 101 days, these are these externalities we don't want to pay for. Mm-hmm. That a company will make a widget and sell it at a low price, but what's not factored in is what sort of things are dumped out the back door into the stream to make that widget, or what the cost of recycling that widget later when it breaks down and you need a new widget. We don't factor those in. And so the company doesn't pay it. We get a cheaper rate. Ultimately, who ends up holding the bag?
All right. Well, again, go to another caller. This is someone in Lamoille, and this is line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Actually, my comment is a bit of a follow-up to the previous caller mm-hmm. about the least cost.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to plastic again, and my husband and I are both in sort of a rural community up here, but we just see literally mountains of garbage that's accumulating around us. And one of the things that we're wondering about is when these manufacturers of both, say, plastic and glass also, glass is not going to decompose over the years. When we have these people putting things in plastic containers, why don't we ask them why they don't use plastic that either has to be recycled or that will break down. We see, apparently there is some, and I don't know enough about it, but there is some study being done with the fact that plastic made from corn is decomposing much more quickly. And I think, you know, for instance, plastic bags, some of them are made out of corn with that very quality in mind. But for instance, I mean, like bottled water, how many tons of plastic come from bottled water alone? And do the bottled water people require us to go recycle it? No. And as the caller said, it's whatever's the cheapest. And I think that we all need to be just really mindful of recycling, no matter what it is. It just seems like we don't force anyone to do something that's both good for us and longer term, for the Earth. But anyway, I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Okay. Thanks. Well, I would assume that, again, though, you'd be in harmony. This is a little bit of a different story. Maybe that's probably somebody else's beat to deal with issues of waste, packaging, recycling, and so forth. But I guess I would expect that pretty much you would say to the caller, yeah, I would certainly agree.
I do agree. There is sort of two interesting efforts underway to fix this problem of this mounting amount of plastic debris. One is the recycling effort, and what's a little surprising to me, and I don't know the stats nationally, but in California, the amount of folks recycling has actually declined over the last 20 years. Fewer people recycle things. At the same time, I think a lot of manufacturers, particularly water bottle manufacturers, and we see certainly a lot of water bottles around, that's almost all recyclable. At the same time, there is the ability to produce more and more containers out of materials that can decompose, whether it's potato starch or corn or these other things. And the problem is that if you get that in the waste stream, that can ruin the recycling efforts because this stuff gums up the works, essentially. They want to melt down these plastics and reform something else, but if you have something that's biodegradable, it gets in that waste stream, the recycling stream, it causes a problem for that. There's an ongoing debate. What's the best way to go?
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Kenneth Weiss. He's a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, has worked for the paper since 1990, and has covered the California coast and oceans for the past 5 years. And beginning back in 2005, he started to do a series of reports on the health of the oceans, jumping off from the fact that people in California do have some concern because it's in their backyard there. He did a lot of traveling. He traveled all over the world, in fact, to report this series. Altered Oceans is the name of the series. And again, if you have access to the internet, the Los Angeles Times is a very nice website that has the articles as well as video and photographs by photographer Rick Loomis, who also contributed to this, and another reporter, Usha Lee McFarling, and they have won a number of awards for this, including a Pulitzer Prize and also a Grantham Prize, which is for environmental reporting. So again, if you're interested in reading some more on the subject, you can go to the paper's website and you can take a look at it.
And there's a very easy link there, which is simply www.latimes.com/oceans, and it'll take you right to the link.
Okay.
So just the paper's website /oceans, and go right there.
The other way that I just found it is actually, if I think probably if people just type Altered Oceans into their web browser, they'll come up with other sites that will link to that. I think I kind of came in through the back door. I didn't go right to the LA Times site, but certainly people can look at it. And again, there's not only can you read the text of the articles, but there's a lot of good things to look at too as well. Really nice, a nicely done website. Well, we have a couple of other callers here, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
This is it's actually very important, and I'm glad you've done this. Whether anybody listens or not, it's debatable. But it's, when people talk about the economics of this, I've argued with economists on this program before about that. I look through economics in a general sense, and look at some of the papers, and you don't see any sort of environmental variable in economic theory. There's something called disutilization, which is more of an insurance term, which means after the damage is no longer utilizable, and that's a variable only after the fact. So, Leslie, you know, you end up with a Malthusian problem because, as you said in your article state, that the ocean appears vast, but in a sense it's really not as vast square mileage-wise, but the life forms in the ocean only go down so far. And I was wondering if you knew anything about the phytoplankton problem, in that the oceans are warming and the phytoplankton from the warmer environments are moving north into the subarctic oceans and stuff like that. And I'm wondering if there's any information about the amount of oxygen they produce in relationship to the cold water phytoplankton. Do you know anything about that?
I know that the shifts in ocean temperature and some of the currents have changed the composition and the different kinds of plankton blooms. Mm-hmm. There was a horrific story that we were not able to get in the series about a big bloom of something called a coccolithophore. It's quite a mouthful, mm-hmm. but it looks like a little plant with, looks like Roman shields all the way around it, made out of calcium carbonate. It is, all that calcium is whitish, and it turns the water soupy green, almost like split pea soup. Mm. A scientist were up there a few years back and noticed all the soupy green. They didn't know what was going on. They were doing a cruise into the Bering Sea, and they noticed that this soup was covered with this what looked like black pepper from aboard a big ship, but was dead shearwaters. Mm. And these are birds that migrate from New Zealand up to the Bering Sea to breed, and there were hundreds of thousands of them floating in the water, and they pulled some up to check them out, and they looked perfectly healthy, except they had nothing in their bellies, and they were starving to death. Mm-hmm. And only years later did they realize that the problem was that this coccolithophore bloom, it turned the sea so murky green that these diving seabirds could not see the fish that they normally eat, and they starved to death.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. I'm really glad you've done this, but I'm just hoping you will listen because it is beyond important. It's like the future of, like, you know, who knows if there will be a crash of major proportions, you know, this sort of like environmental scary sort of thing. But it's just amazing. I mean, I think I read part of your piece about the plastic found in isolated beaches, like little elements or molecules of plastic were found when they did samples of sand. So thank you very much. I really appreciate your work.
All right.
Really important.
Thank you. We'll talk again with someone here in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. This is for the woman who called from a small town. I was visiting a family in a small town near Champaign, Urbana, and previous to this visit, they had shown absolutely no interest in recycling. And the young son was collecting the garbage from the waste baskets in the house. And the dad said, "Did you check for recycling stuff?" And I was so surprised. And I asked why, and he said, "We have to buy stickers to put on every bag of trash that we put out. And that really is adding up. And so we're taking out everything we can." So if the woman lives in a community where there's community garbage picking up, she might think about that method. It certainly worked with this family.
Okay. I do know, again, this is getting into a sort of a different area, but I think that for people who are concerned about these particular issues, that I think in various communities around the country, one of the things that they found is that volume-based pricing on garbage is one of the ways that you encourage people to separate out of the waste stream those things that can be recycled. So if you give people that kind of incentive, then maybe that's one way to get people thinking about it. Although, again, the issue is then, okay, once you've got people to separate that stuff out, then do you give them something to do with it? That's another issue as well. So it gets pretty complicated pretty quick, unfortunately.
And it's very hard to change human behavior.
One of the things that we haven't touched, we have 3-4 minutes left. One of the things we haven't touched on that I think is, again, another facet of this that's really interesting, and something perhaps also that maybe people who live inland don't think about unless they have spent time on the coast is the problem with red tides and things like that. Again, it goes back to the changes in the chemistry that foster this growth of algae. And not only is it a problem because maybe it's just not real attractive and it means that you can't use the water, but actually these things produce some pretty powerful toxins that can be airborne, and that so not only can you not go in the water or walk along the beach, that some ways inland it really can affect people's health and quality of life. And that's another one of these issues that's you're starting to see that kind of problem a lot of places around the world.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because for a lot of folks in the Midwest, they love to vacation down on the west coast, the Gulf Coast of Florida. And there's been a big problem with red tides. And there you don't have to set foot in the water or eat shellfish to get sick. But this is a toxin that becomes aerosolized. And actually, when the wind blows on shore, when there's one of these algae blooms, it actually can make it very difficult to breathe. And physicians down there in the emergency rooms know when a red tide is coming, because the emergency rooms are filled with people coughing and sneezing, and they don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Are there other places where you're seeing either problems like that or problems with the growth of other kinds of things that really go beyond just saying that they're nuisance species that are causing problems in waters around the coast, but are actually posing really serious health problems, either to people whose work involves being around the marine environment, or just people who just happen to live near the water?
Yeah, absolutely. This is happening on coastal oceans all around the world. We went to a place in Australia called Moreton Bay, where there's a very strange and bizarre situation. Seems like science fiction, but fishermen there have been plagued by boils and rashes, even affecting their private parts. And at first they didn't understand what was going on, but later they realized that it was connected to this black hairy growth, this weed that they were pulling up in their nets. And only after it was later ID'd caused the mass evacuation of the university botany lab when its fumes came out of the drying oven, did they realize it's an ancient type of cyanobacteria, one of the ancient kinds of bacteria that once ruled the seas about 2.5 billion years ago. Very toxic stuff, and it's back, and there it's growing at an astonishing rate.
Have you seen based on the just where you live and around California, the people who are who read the paper, some feeling that the story got through? And that not only are people saying, gee, that's a real serious issue, and I'm glad you wrote that, and I'm glad I know about that, to going to the point where they're actually starting perhaps to ask some questions like, well, is there something that I can do in my daily life to address this problem? Or maybe even getting to the point of saying, well, maybe I should sit down and write a letter to my, I don't know who, member of Congress, member in the state legislature, something like that, where people are actually, it looks like people are moved to do something.
Right. Yeah, I think so. And I think that the series was successful in one respect, that I set out to do something that newspapers don't normally do, and that is look at the slow creep of change or environmental decay. Typically, we focus on the big cataclysmic events. And this, I think, connected with a lot of readers, particularly as we get older. So we think of whatever is natural as when we were young, and then what was unnatural as we age. And this helped a lot of folks, I think, remember, I remember when I was a kid and we used to swim in the waters and we didn't get sick. Or we'd go out fishing, we'd catch a lot of fish. Well, that's changed now. And this sort of made a lot of folks, I think, here, particularly in California, where we have a great connection with the ocean, saying, well, things aren't the way they used to be, and why is that, and what's changed, and what should we do about it?
Mm-hmm. So do you think you've collected enough material here to write a book? Had you been thinking about that?
I have been thinking about it, but not doing it.
Well, you probably have other assignments, other stories to write, other things like that probably occupy your time.
That's exactly right. It's always chasing some other story, yeah. But I would like to put this together into something with hard covers.
So is this, are you, this, this going to, you think this is going to be your beat now for the foreseeable future, continuing to write about blue water and coastal ocean issues?
Oh, yeah. That, this is a perfect a confluence of my personal and professional interests. I love to surf and scuba dive and fish, and so this is really the perfect beat for me, if you will.
Well, again, for people who have, if you have internet access and you'd like to read this, this award-winning series of articles written by our guest, Kenneth Weiss, in the Los Angeles Times, just again, the easiest way is probably go to www.latimes.com/oceans, and that will take you right to that. And you can read the stories. There's video, there's photographs. It's a really nice website so that you can take a look at it. And Mr. Weiss, well, thank you very much for giving some of your time.
Well, thank you, David, for having me.